Today is very interesting on Radio Gorgeous because we're going to talk about a subject which is very close to my heart. It's an area of southern Italy and it's a region called Puglia. You might have heard of it because it's becoming more and more fashionable every year. Everyone seems to want to go there. But I've been going there for about 13 or 14 years and I was very excited to get in the mail a book that came through to me and it was called Finding Myself in Puglia. And I have the author here today who's Lane B. Brown and she lived in Puglia, which is much more than I've ever done. I've only been a tourist there or even a second homer, I think you could call me. So I'm very, very excited and she has written a very truthful and honest account about living in Puglia, which is a region of extremes. People don't know that. They come and see it's all summery, but actually it is, as we're going to talk about, it is an extraordinary place. The book's called Finding Myself in Puglia, and she is, as I say, Lane B. Brown, and she has worked as a nurse, and she's presently a counsellor, and she's back from Puglia now, and she lives in North Norfolk with two animals. Her dog Basil and her cat Munchkin, which who comes from Puglia, so il palo italiano. Okay, so gorgeous to meet you. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Lane.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. So, why Puglia? Because there's the whole of the world, members the whole of Italy, and members Puglia.
Well, it kind of started as an accident, really, because I was at work one day and I was walking up the stairs doing a 12-hour shift. I was a nursing sister in a cardiac unit in northwest London. And I suddenly thought to myself, I want to learn another language before I die. And it just popped into my head and it seemed really important. So I thought about France and one of the consultants at work said, well, France is okay, but it goes down to minus 10 in the winter and you won't be able to go out. So I sort of had the vision of lying under a pile of coats and dying with my arm outstretched with a piece of cheese in my hand. And I thought, well, that's not going to be for me. And I was actually dating someone who lived in London and he was quite well travelled. And I said, I actually think I might like to go live in Italy because it'd be warmer. And he said, well, why don't you try Puglia? And he showed me a map and then he showed me like a magazine with the pictures of the Trullos, which are like these conical shaped buildings, which are medieval. And I thought, yeah, that's where I want to go. So the following year, I booked a villa in a small rural area called Celia Messapica. And I hired a car and I was going to go to Puglia on my own and just drive around and see where I wanted to live. Then a good, very good friend of mine called Ali said, I can't bear the thought of you going on your own. I'm going to come with you. So she came with me. So we picked up the car at the airport and I shunted into the car in front and went up the
curb. Sounds like Italian. They wouldn't be that bothered, though. That's the funny thing. Italians aren't that bothered if you're a terrible driver. So it goes, I'm really acceptable there.
Yeah. And I spent the whole week just tearing off the wing mirrors of all these unsuspecting cars. And a couple of times I pulled out on the wrong side of the road and things like that. And the following year, I went back and thought I'd go to somewhere near the sea, and I found this really small village and stayed in this villa. And then
Santa Sabina,
which was absolutely beautiful,
which is 20 minutes from my house. Like, and I go there every time I go to Puglia because I go to a restaurant there. Yeah, on the front,
Miramare.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So kind of did a repeat performance, but actually stayed in this villa and. Literally a five.
What time of year was it?
It was October, but it was very hot and very warm.
Yeah.
And a 5-minute conversation changed my life because my sister, who came with me on the second trip, said, why don't you ask if you can stay here? So I did. And the lady that I was staying, got the house from, spoke very good English. And
Now that's very unusual, as we know.
It is very unusual. Yeah. She used to be a nanny for an American family. Yeah. And she said, how long do you want to stay for? And I said, well, about 2 years. And she said, why do you want to live in Italy? And I just looked at her. I was so emotional. And she said, you want a different life, don't you? Mm. And it was just meant to be. It was just meant to be. So that's how I ended up in Santa Sabina.
Fabulous. Now, Santa Sabina, the thing about it is that it is, it's a holiday place for people really that live in Carovigno, which is a town about 3 kilometres up the road. Mm. Because what's amazing is the lifestyle in Italy. You don't have to be rich to have a really good lifestyle. And that's why they're much, much cleverer than us. Because you can meet someone who is, you know, just got a job like a cleaner or a nurse or anything, and they've got 3 homes. And you go, how come? And they go, oh, my auntie left me a place in the country. And then another one said, oh, and I've got a place in Santa Sabina. And then I've got a flat in the town. It's like, great. And they live in all 3 in the year. So they spend like winter in the flat. And then in Easter, they go and have a lovely lunch in their country place. And then the summer, they'll decamp for 3 months. And I just thought, they've got it right. Now, did you find that you'd got it right when you got there? How many surprises and shocks were you in store for?
Well, there weren't really that many shocks, really, because I think I just decided to go with the flow. And the weather was quite surprising, I suppose, because in the winter, it can get very windy and very wet. So the first Christmas, I had a Christmas tree outside and decorated it, and it all blew off within about 5 minutes.
Sounds
hurricane
right.
Winds,
yeah.
Very wet. And, of course, in the summer, it gets very, very hot.
Did you have aircon?
Well, the aircon didn't work until the last year, and it's lucky it did work in the last year because I had to shut myself away and put it on 16 degrees.
Why?
And just hide away.
You found it too hot?
Just so that I could finish the book.
Oh, so you were writing it there?
I was writing it there, and I actually finished it in 2016, just before I left, because I left in 2017.
Fantastic. So you went there to find yourself, to learn a language and write a book, and you achieved all of them.
Well, I'm not too sure about learning the language because it is that thing where to be truly fluent, you have to be able to converse with immediacy. And I was always a few seconds behind. But everybody was really patient with me. They really were. And it is quite a difficult language grammatically to learn. It's a very beautiful language. It's a very lyrical language. And I went through 2 Italian teachers. The first one was in Ostuni, actually, a very nice man, but he wouldn't speak English to me. And after the first month, I was just in floods of tears because I felt like a fish out of water. I suddenly missed my family. I suddenly missed hearing the Anglo-Saxon tones. And
you suddenly were homesick.
I was
very,
suddenly,
very violently.
Yes, very violently homesick. Mm. And as soon as I broke down in tears, he started to speak English to me. And I thought, oh, hallelujah, please. I just want to say how awful I feel. Please give me a hug. He didn't give me a hug, but... And then I found another Italian teacher, who was based in Pascarossa, which is in the Itria Valley. And she actually had a Trullo. In fact, the front cover of the book is my friend Ali walking into one of her Trullos. And she'd brought up children in England. So we used to speak English all the time and learn Italian, and I needed that. I needed that connection because...
Did she become a friend?
She did become a friend, and she's still a friend. Her name's Anna. And I think when you give everything away and you lose everything, you have to make... Even though I was ready to live on my own, I still needed to have close connections with people because as human beings, we need that engagement. And I found that with Anna, and eventually after about 6 months I said, oh, let's not bother you being my teacher anymore, let's just be friends. And I learnt Italian online after that.
Wow.
And then I could just go around there and eat her delicious home-cooked Puglian food and not have to worry about verb conjugations.
Now, let's talk about why and how did you get there, really? You know what I mean? Why did you end up in, I mean, as in, was there a trauma in your life? What really happened for you to go?
Well, I'd got divorced quite a few years before, in 2004. And I just went on automatic pilot and just worked all the hours I could. And I realised that I was losing connection with life because I literally was just eating, sleeping and working. And I don't want to say all...
So do you think you were depressed?
I think I was lost. Mm. I think I did have probably a bit of depression in the first few years, but I think I was lost.
Was your identity bound up with your partner?
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think when you've...
Did you have children?
Yes, I've got two adult children. I'm now a grandmother, so...
Don't you look too young.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. But I think you do. I think you do meld with the other person.
And especially if you're an empathetic person, which you obviously are.
Yes. And so it you do lose yourself. And I wrote in the book somewhere, I didn't know who I was outside of a relationship for many years. So when I realised that I needed to have a relationship with myself... first and foremost, and to stop looking for a relationship in another person, like find another boyfriend or another husband.
Yeah.
And that's when the seed of the idea of living abroad really came to fruition. And a lot of people thought I was a bit mad to do it. And I literally did give away my furniture, and the age concern was brimming with all my clothes, and I'd go in there and all my clothes that I never wore would be hanging there. And there's something very freeing about doing that.
So you gave up most of your possessions?
I gave up most of my possessions. And
it's quite spiritual, actually, isn't it?
Yes, it's very spiritual. You get down to you, at the heart of you, really. And I just had a few odd things in storage, and I literally took with me books, which are very important to me because I'm an avid reader, and I couldn't have written the book without being a well-read person, and a lovely red, cable knit woolen blanket from John Lewis, which was my little...
You do need it in Puglia.
You do need it, believe it or not, in the evenings.
Yeah.
And a few bits of clothes. And this very nice man called Dave brought Basil over in a van, and I flew over. And after...
What sort of dog is Basil?
Because
obviously we're very into dogs on Radio Gorgeous.
Well, he's a Basset Hound. So
I bet they hadn't seen many Basset Hounds in
Well, he was a bit of a celebrity in the village. Yeah. Everybody knew him.
Yeah.
And he did go missing at one stage. I think it was about in the second year.
Wow.
And I came home to England for a weekend to see family and what have you. And I'd left him with Anna. And I rang her on the Saturday and said, oh, how's Basil? And she said, Basil's not here. I said, what do you mean he's not here? She said, I let him out for a wee and he didn't come back. And I've been looking for him and I'm hoarse. I can't speak anymore. And I couldn't speak after she spoke to me on the phone.
Well, because you're so shocked.
Because I was so shocked. And anyway, I said, fine, I'm going to book a flight home. I'll come to you and we'll go and look for him together.
Oh.
And
because he was your best friend at this point.
He was my best friend. Yeah. He was very important to me. And I arranged to go out and see some friends that night. And as I was going out, the phone rang and he said, hello. He said, I've got your dog. And he was an Italian lawyer that lived in Lecce. And what Basil had done is he'd gone out of Anna's house across the countryside and he'd walked 9 kilometres to Cistanino, which was the next town. And he sat down with two men at a bar And 1 o'clock in the morning, one Italian said to the other Italian, "Is your dog a boy or a girl?" And the other Italian said, "That's not my dog." And so he just sat and waited. I don't know what he was waiting for.
Did he have a collar? And
he had a collar with sono inglese, which means I am English. And his name and my mobile phone number.
Thank God for that.
They took him home and then they rang me the next day. But they did say that if they couldn't get hold of me, they would have kept him.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
But yeah, that's
so Basil actually was trying to get home, wasn't he? Because Cistanino, as I say, is, you know, if he'd turned left, he could have got, I mean, the trouble is he'd have to walk over the motorway, which would have been very dangerous.
It would have been very dangerous. Yeah. Well, I think that he just followed the voice of the Italians, thinking, oh, Italian, he doesn't know the difference between Italian and English, but I think he thinks, oh, they might know my mum, perhaps. But anyway.
That's an incredibly clever dog.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Bassett's a tenth on from the bottom of the least intelligent dogs. But, I mean, you know,
how do you quantify intelligence?
Yeah,
He's got emotional intelligence.
Yeah, if you measure intelligence by biddability, then he's not very biddable. He's not biddable at all. He's stubborn.
Like his owner, perhaps?
Well, I don't know about that, but... yeah, so that was a bit of an experience.
Yes, that was a bit of a trauma. So you decided you're going to write a book. You found somewhere to live. You start writing. Now, also another angle of the book that I really picked on was it's another theme that's deep, and that is loneliness.
Mm.
Can you explain, because it's quite a big theme in the book, actually?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I tried to... I wrote a chapter, Being Alone But Not Being Lonely. Actually, I'm just going to quote something from the Huffington Post, if I may. "Aloneness is a presence, fullness, aliveness, joy of being, overflowing love. You are complete. Nobody is needed. You are enough." And I think it's about... really learning to have pleasure in just being alone and not feeling lonely, because I felt lonely in a room full of people. I felt lonely being at home with my family because I didn't feel connected. And through living alone in a country where I literally knew nobody and I had Basil obviously as company, I really learned to enjoy my company, my own company, and to not feel alone, which I think was just so important.
It means that, forever you're sort of safe and you're sorted, really, doesn't it? So if someone comes into your life, that'll be pleasant, but there'll never be a kind of desperation or a need to look outwards, you know. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you found an inner peace.
Yeah. Well, I've just highlighted this bit about in the book that I've written, and I just want to read it. And it says, "I may have escaped to a different country, but I've tried to not escape myself, and I've tried to pull all the different parts of myself into a whole, a more integrated and self-aware me. The silence is there, but it's all mine and can be yours. Embrace the silence and inhabit the space of being alone. Just at this moment, the silence is only broken by the tapping of the computer keys, a 30-mile-an-hour wind that is ripping through the palm trees, and the gentle hum of the stove. The loudest internal sounds are my thoughts that I'm transferring to the page. I'm owning the silence and owning my thoughts."
Lovely.
So that's what it was about. It was about really getting to know myself. Just... enjoying an unstructured day of chasing a sunrise or chasing a sunset, taking photographs, noticing the curve of a boat, the silhouette of a fisherman on the sea, waiting for the cafe to open at 6 in the morning. And it was really a gloriously self-indulgent time, I would say.
And it was obviously very healing.
And it was enormously healing, actually. Enormously healing.
Had you ever... do you think there was a reason why you hadn't found yourself? I mean, did you rush into relationships from relationship when you were young, you know, or did you have a dominating parent? I'm just wondering about your upbringing.
Well, I got married when I was very young. I was only 20.
Gosh.
And I had my first child at 25.
Yeah.
And I'd already always had a career as a nurse. So it's like juggling motherhood plus being a nurse. And then I trained to be a counsellor. And so I was always rushing from one thing to another. I always used to say I was either rushing towards something or rushing away from something.
Also, being a carer, your job is to listen to others. So it's like maybe you had to put yourself to one side in your job. And being a mother and being a wife.
Yeah, I think I did actually. And I think that when I was divorced and actually on my own, I found that difficult then to nurture myself. And it wasn't until about 6 or 7 years post-divorce that I actually realised that I needed to do something for me to feed myself. And that ended up with me going and living in a different country. And although the book is about examining myself inwardly and my own internal journey, it's also a very funny book, but it's about the stories of me meeting people, you know, the story I've just told about Basil going missing, trying to learn the language. And funny things seem to happen to me every day. And also I've related it to my old life as well, you know, what it was like living in England and funny stories. So it is a very funny book as well, and I hope that people will find it inspiring, funny and poignant.
So maybe that's what your personality is, do you think?
I think it is, yeah. Mm. I've got a very dry sense of humour, and I do see the funny side of a lot of situations, but equally, I like to be engaged with people and I like to... have deep and meaningful relationships with people. And obviously,
and did you find that with Poolians?
I think that I didn't learn the language well enough in order to form deep relationships with Italians, but I did form relationships with Italians that could speak English as well.
Yeah, and I can relate to that. Yeah.
And I remember saying to Lily, who I had the house from, can we always speak in English? I said, because if I'm upset, you'll know I'm upset. And if you're upset, I'll know you're upset. But if we're speaking Italian, we might miss something.
Yeah. Be a bit more formal. And
that was our feeling language. Oh. That was our feeling language. So that worked out really well.
Yeah. Now let's talk about, because I found it very exciting that in the book, you know, you went through the kind of years and the seasons. And it seems like sort of every month there was always something to do with food, because food, I'd say, is the most dominating factor in Puglia, apart from the weather. We all know the Italians love food, but the Puglians are obsessed by it. And I would say, and I've travelled a lot around Italy, it is the best food in Italy. So if you are interested in food, it is a fascinating place. I mean, I remember reading in your book something about you went to like a hazelnut festival one time.
Oh, it's a chestnut festival.
That was it.
It's a chestnut festival, yes. Well, they do celebrate everything. So chestnuts, southern Italy was very poor, which is why there was a lot of emigration to America. And I think there's something like 83% of Americans are from southern... American Italian, sorry, are from southern Italy. Because when Italy was made into one country in 1861, the Puglians were... not just the Puglians, but the southern Italians were left with the wrong end, it's not the wrong end of the stick, what do you call it? The hard end of the stick.
Yeah.
So they couldn't market all their goods and things, so there was a lot of poverty. And so chestnuts, I think it's September, October, are harvested, and they make they used to make flour out of them, so they bake with them. So it's a big celebration, the Chestnut Festival, and you could get chestnut ice cream, chestnut liqueur, chestnut anything really. Everything is seasonal, as you know, and
yeah, and they really, when something's in season, they go mad for it.
Like the mushrooms as well, yeah, and all of that.
So when mushrooms are seasoned, it's all they will eat as well. It's like they'll glut on it, won't they? They get obsessed by it until the next thing that comes along, which is really brilliant.
And preserve them as well.
Yeah.
And then you've got the figs as well that come out, and the new figs, I think, come out in June. So I'd have bowlfuls of figs being left on my gate. But the main thing in Puglia, and especially where I lived, is the fresh seafood, you know, like the tuna, the octopus, and the squid. If you ordered tuna in a restaurant and the boat hadn't been out that day, sometimes they wouldn't serve it to you because it had to be that fresh. Papata di cozza, which is mussels in a wine, garlic and pepper sauce, was like one of my favourite things. And you're right, the food is just absolutely delicious.
And you just have that with a hunk of bread, and that is just the most, and a glass of wine, and it's like a perfect meal, isn't it?
Well, it is for you, except for I can't eat the bread.
Oh, gluten.
I'm wheat intolerant. But a big issue. Yeah. That was a big issue.
Yeah. Because think of everything they do: pizza, bread, focaccia, bread, tirali, everything.
So, funny enough, some of the restaurants would start to serve gluten-free pizza, and you could buy gluten-free bread and pasta in Italy. It was just being recognised as a problem for people. But there was, you know, the salads, fresh salads and fish and everything else. So there was always, and cheese, the burrata.
What do you eat the cheese? Oh, yeah, so burrata is, it's like a very, very big creamy mozzarella.
Yeah, it's the end of the mozzarella.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
I never knew that. And it tastes like double cream.
And it's gorgeous.
But what happens if you wanted a sort of carb then? What would you cook rice, or what would you do?
Well, rice or Anna used to get loads of gluten-free stuff as well, and she'd give me gluten-free pasta. So, you know, it was okay. Available. Yeah. It was available, yeah. And gluten-free bread. And you just get used to it and then watch everyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
Guzzle down the fresh bread. And the focaccia is absolutely divine.
Yes, yeah. How do you know the focaccia is divine?
Well, because it looks gorgeous. And it smells gorgeous. Every shop in Puglia will sell great big tablets of focaccia, and you tell them how many pieces you want and they'll slice them off for you.
God, I'm just thinking of it now, focaccia dripping in olive oil with a few olives and tomato on it, with maybe some oregano. God, I mean, I find that it's just, I love the oil, I love the oregano, I love the olives, I love the kind of basis of sort of everything. I mean, here I've always got, because we own, our villa is an old olive mill, so we have trees. So the lovely Santoros, who we bought it from, always give us olive oil, so we always got to get a 20 kilo case to bring back the kind of 10 litres of olive oil. But it's so lovely, it just means every day I'm eating Puglia, you know, and I always bring back herbs, and especially oregano, you know, it's lovely. You get, it's like a sort of bunch of oregano, and oregano can only grow wild, so whenever you see it anywhere else, or they say you can grow it in England, no, it's marjoram. Oregano just makes everything just taste amazing. And then also I always bring garlic back. So it's like I always can have, you know, just a little bit of Puglia. So I'll just explain to people, Puglia, it's known as like the bread basket of Italy, no, the table of Italy, because it's where most of the olive oil comes from, because there are 60 million olive trees. Also, it's where the durum wheat in northern Puglia, it's these incredibly big fields, like the size of, all you can see is wheat. I drove through it this year and it's just like everything's yellow. And that's where all the durum wheat, so the hard pasta, they don't have egg pasta because, again, they were poor. So egg was like a decadent thing. So that's a northern thing. And then the other thing is the grapes, you know. So every wine in Italy has a bit of Puglian wine as its base, because Puglia was kind of known as, even Cinzano, all those kind of drinks that are really trendy now. When you have a Negroni, it's got a little bit of wine from Puglia in it. So they really were kind of like the base of everything. Also, 60% of vegetables are grown in Puglia. And I had a friend that came down, and she had a Roman friend who went to the market. As you know, the markets there are amazing. And he said, he was from Rome, and he went, what vegetable's that? So they grow vegetables there, but even Romans don't know what they are. So whenever I say to someone, I see something very strange, like stringing or strange shape, and I go, how do you cook it? And they always say con pasta. So it's like, not there. It's like, but I don't know how, what to do with it. So it is, you know, and then seafood is by the sea, as you say, the freshest thing in the world. And then also inland is meat, and they're famous for barbecues. So, you know, you can literally go, especially Celia, which you talked about, Celia Masapica, is, you know, so I really urge people to go to Puglia, because especially if you like eating. So tell me more things that you got up to when you were there.
More things that I got up to. Well, I think it was just, I tried to integrate myself into community as much as possible. So I did have some expat friends, but I mix mainly with the Italians. So, you know, if you go to a party, I think the thing is, what I decided was that I was always there as an observer. So I was quite happy sitting at a large Italian table. And even though I've had very rudimentary Italian, I probably wouldn't understand what people were saying because they were speaking in dialect. I mean, the dialect is what's spoken at home. And
each town has a dialect as well.
Each town is completely different. The dialect is completely different. Mm. And so it's not written down, but it's like standard Italian is spoken at work and with friends from different villages, but at home is the dialect that is
so you couldn't used. Understand just
so
me,
I wouldn't be able to understand and somebody from Ostuni probably wouldn't be able to understand someone
it's true
from Caravigno,
because we had a man came round to do something in our orchard, and he was stung by a bee, and he kept and Ottavio, who is our man from Ostuni, was saying, what have you been stung by? What have you been stung by? And he kept saying this word, and Ottavio didn't know what it was. The Giustinino word for bee. And as we know, Giustinino is 5 kilometres away. I mean, it is extraordinary how their lives are so centred around their town, as opposed to us, who our identity might be from first of all, from like Britain, and then we'd say, oh, we're English, and then we'd say our region, you know, like I'd say, oh, I'm from Yorkshire, so I'd sort of say, yeah, I'm a Yorkshire woman. And where are you from originally?
Where am I from originally? Mm. Well, West London, but after I was married, I moved to Buckinghamshire, to Maidenhead.
So where do you identify yourself as from?
I suppose Maidenhead, really, because that's where my children were brought up.
But what I mean is that that's an area. We don't really see ourselves as like, oh, my God, I'm this town and that town. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't
as much.
Say I'm Maidendonian or anything.
No, exactly.
But I think what happens with Italian life is that it chisels down to the village and then it chisels down further to the Italian family table. So each family, as long as they've got food on the table,
which is sacred to them,
and their family around the table, then it doesn't matter what else happens, because which is why the government's always in such a mess, because as long as they've got what they need, they're not bothered about what they're doing in Milan or whatever.
And also food is love to them. Which for us, it's a kind of function, you know, and we like it or something, or we like going out for an Indian or something, but we don't think of it as love. Whereas them, as I say, it's sacred. So it's taken very seriously. So that's why something like 98% of Italian households still have Sunday lunch. You know, they, you know, eating round the table is so important. And then, as you say, they get very, very excited, like cherry season's coming, or when in Easter, when you go out there and the new fave beans have come out, and they get really excited. And these are these kind of broad beans, and they have them raw with cheese. They get, you know, like, to them, that's really exciting. They also eat things that you'd never, ever even heard of in your life. There's something called, and this is made of fave beans, it's called fave. And it's this dry bean puree, and it is literally, it looks a bit like hummus. In fact, it is a bit like hummus, because you can get it, you can get the beans in Middle Eastern shops in England. And again, it's like they eat that all year round, and they eat it with veg, and it's sort of, they put olive oil on it. And that's when they were peasants, that's all they ate, because they couldn't afford meat. And, you know, that's an extraordinary thing. Where else in Europe was it, where they eat piles of, you know, of legumes? I mean, you know, I just think it is, it's got such a strong identity, don't you think, Pelia?
Oh, very much so. And it is a bit like Greece.
Yes.
It's on the Adriatic, but it's very Mediterranean.
Well, they are Greeks, sorry. Yeah. Because it was called Minor Graecia for 600 years before the Romans went there. And I've done lots of research into the tribes and things. And they are, I mean, nearly, I mean, you meet some, their surname's Greco, their surname's Pallas, the names of places like Polignano. And if you go to Greece, you see they are the same people. They're smaller, they're dark, you know, they are, you know, and also what's really funny is whenever my children go to to our house in Pula, they always watch our big fat Greek wedding. Mm. And they always say, because it's so similar, the culture, because they are, I mean, they probably be in denial if you say to them, sorry, you're Greek, they say, no, I'm an Italian. But, you know, they invaded, and their culture. Also, when you say to them, I'd like an antipasti, they bring a mezze. I mean, and their houses are white with flat roofs. Yeah. And I really wanted a place in Greece. That's how we ended up. Ended up in Puglia, because I said, I want Greece. I really want sunshine. I want simplicity. I want white buildings.
Yeah.
This is what I was brought up on. The Mediterranean for me is this. My husband said to me, well, the Mediterranean for me is Italy. It's eating. It's, you know. So he found a Lonely Planet guide and he read it, and it said there's a place that's like Greece in Italy.
And it's Puglia.
Yeah.
And it is like it. I mean, they dance is it La Pisica? Never know how to pronounce it properly. I always get corrected. But it's very Grecian-like. It's lots of tambourines and wailing and singing, and the dancing.
Yeah, kind of wailing. And,
the dancing is very passionate. Whereas when I went up to Tuscany, they're all dancing like to an umpa-pa band, and doing a waltz. And I just thought, it is so different. And I just found the southern Italian so warm and so open and so friendly. And you could literally ask someone where somebody lived and they'd link arms with you, and then they'd invite you in for coffee. And, you know, they're just such lovely people, the southern Italians, and beautiful people. I mean, the girls are so beautiful, and the men, and a lot of them have got really big brown Bambi eyes,
massive,
and they really are a beautiful race of people, and I just absolutely loved living there, and it was a privilege, and I'm just so glad I wrote about it.
Now, I'm interested to know, why did you come home?
Well, because I'd finished the book, and I kind of felt that I'd done what I needed to do. I didn't find a rich vineyard owner.
Was that plan B?
I remember Lily say to me, Alfredo likes you, and he's like a grey-haired coach driver, and you just think, oh my God, you know, please help me.
Now you shouldn't be judgmental. He's a good cook and he owns a bit of land, you know, come on.
Oh dear. So yeah, and so I kind of ended up in Norfolk, living near the sea.
Okay, we must actually, there is one story I just want to finish on, and that is about Munchkin. We mentioned Munchkin at the beginning.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the story of Munchkin the cat?
Well, you know, living in Italy, they don't have a neutering programme, so there's always lots and lots of cats. And because I was there all year round, you know, I'd just like to say to my fellow villagers, I didn't feed them all the time. Other people did, in case they blame me.
What, the cat invasion?
Yeah, but there would have been about 30 cats.
What?
Around and about, but only one or two of them would come into the garden. And in the September before I left to come back to England, I went outside and you know, there's lots of palm trees, but I had a huge yucca plant, which was about 10 foot tall in the garden. There was this little kitten up there. And I just looked up there and I said, what are you doing up there, little munchkin? And I pulled her down from the tree thinking, I'll just put her outside the gate. You know, she can have fun with the 30 odd other cats out there. And she nestled into my arm and said, oh, I like you. So I said, oh dear, to myself. So I kept her outside for about 4 nights, and every morning she'd be by the front door saying, can I come in, please? So I let her in, and I had a spayed and everything else, and she had a pet passport, and she came back in the van with Basil and Dave, and she now lives in Norfolk, and she looks very much like
Babushka.
Wow. Wow. Josephine's cat. Like, yeah. Could be twins.
Exactly. We've got the same life, haven't we?
Yeah.
Fabulous. Now, have you been back to Puglia since?
I haven't, but I would like to go back.
I think you've got to hear about this summer,
would like to go back because...
you've got to give them all the book.
Well, exactly. And Lily would like to see me, and there's a few other people that I'd like to see. And it's really funny because... I spoke to Lily about a month after I left, and she said, Mimo and I are very upset, not just a little bit, we're very, very upset, as though it's all my fault. But that was absolutely lovely because they were my family. They treated me like family, and it was just an incredible, incredible experience. But Puglia is such a beautiful place. It's very unspoiled, and... I would just urge people to go and have a holiday there. It's a beautiful place and the people are lovely.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Lane B. Brown, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and finding myself in Puglia. Where can people buy the book?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, but it is available more widely now, I hope, by a distributor. But... Amazon.
And is that amazon.co.uk?
.co.uk, yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. And it's been really thrilling for me as well to be able to hear stories about one of the most wonderful places in the world. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
And for more amazing women, go to radiogorgeous.com.